The 15th annual Bard Summerscape Festival features 7 weeks of world-class opera, theater, dance, cabaret, film, and music, including the 29th annual Bard Music Festival, Rimsky-Korsakov and His World. Gideon Lester, Director of Theater and Performance Programs at Bard and Artistic Director for Summerscape Dances for Quartets, is here along with acclaimed actress Kathleen Chalfant, who is performing in Four Quartets as the narrator, reading T.S. Eliot's poems. We'll also learn about a new production of Leonard Bernstein's Peter Pan, which we just got a little taste of. Gideon Lester and Kathleen Chalfant, welcome to the Roundtable. What a delight to have you both here.
How very nice to be here, Joe. Thank you.
Great pleasure to be back with you, Joe.
Thank you very, very much. Gideon, let us begin with you of what it is like to put this festival together, and especially, some of it, you knew you had to do Bernstein, right? I mean,
yes, it's the Bernstein centenary, and it would have been a missed opportunity not to. But we also knew that, Bard is a very special place. We try and bring to the public works that are underrepresented and not well known.
Right.
And it turned out that Bernstein had written a Broadway musical version of Peter Pan in 1950 that absolutely nobody knew. And this seemed the perfect opportunity during his centenary year to bring it to life.
Now, while that is happening, as I mentioned, of course, there is Four Quartets, mm-hmm. which, as in the very brief walk from the green room to the studio, you were telling me this is something that you've been working on for a very long period of time.
We've been working on it for 3 years. 3 years ago in Summerscape, we presented the work of the great New York choreographer Pam Tanowitz. And in that program, one of the dances that she presented had a very beautiful name. It's called A Broken Frame, wherein there is a broken story, forgive me, wherein there is no ecstasy. And I asked her about the title, and she told me that Wherein There Is No Ecstasy is a quote from T.S. Eliot's poem Four Quartets. And I said 3 years ago, I love Four Quartets. And we started talking about it and realized that 2018 was going to be the 75th anniversary of Eliot's publishing the poems. And sitting in a cafe in Tivoli, New York, I said to her, why don't we commission you to create a dance setting of Four Quartets? And 3 years later, with a long and winding journey, that's exactly what's happening.
And when did you become a part of the conversation to be the
I can't the remember now. I think it's been nearly a year.
It's been nearly a year, yeah.
Nearly a year, and it was one of those things that... It's a terrible thing to say, but when someone asks you to do something like this and you say, what, did everyone else die?
And we said, we can't imagine approaching anybody other than Kathleen Chalfant to be the voice of T.S. Eliot for
it's
us.
It's just heavenly to do this. And we've had this wonderful time now. We're in nearly the end of the second week of rehearsal. And it's been astonishing, particularly at this awful time, to be in a room surrounded by these extraordinary dancers and to say these words and the music of Kaija Saariaho and the images of Bryce Marden. And somehow it's one of those moments in your life when you think, I just want to do this. Nothing else. I just want to do this for the rest of my life.
It seems as a very kind of a battle of the senses, in the sense of, because when I hear, especially with you reading, that I would want to close my eyes just to bathe in the words, mm-hmm. but then that would deprive yourself of the other, what else is going on there?
Well, it's a beautifully complex evening that unites, as Kathy said, the words of T.S. Eliot, the music of Kaija Saariaho, maybe the leading contemporary composer of our day, who became last year only the second woman ever to have an opera produced at the Metropolitan Opera, and the paintings of the great minimalist contemporary painter Bryce Marden. But it's a kind of synesthesia that unites beautiful choreography, great music, extraordinary words, and beautiful paintings. And I hope that our audience will agree that all of these forms speak to each other and complement each other. Of course, Eliot loved many art forms. Mm. And I think the key thing here is that T.S. Eliot was a great dance lover. And actually, he writes about dance pretty extensively in the poems. And that was the key reason to ask Pam to create this work, is that Eliot was going to the dance in London and in Paris almost every night that he could. And he keeps turning to dance again and again as a central metaphor to describe the impossibility of expressing the most profound elements of human experience in words.
I might
say, you have an example.
An example. At the still point of the turning world, neither flesh nor fleshless, neither from nor towards, at the still point, there the dance is, but neither arrest nor movement, and do not call it fixity where past and future are gathered, neither movement from nor towards, neither ascent nor decline, except for the point, the still point, there would be no dance, and there is only the dance.
Wow, that's beautiful. How much of the work do you end up reading on stage? Is it the whole?
Oh, we read. Kathy will read the whole thing. It lasts about an hour. It's a series of four long poems that Eliot started working on in 1936, and published in four segments. He didn't know when he began writing the first poem, Burnt Norton, that it was going to be a series of four poems. He thought he was writing one poem about an experience, a kind of Alice Through the Looking Glass experience that he had in a garden in Gloucestershire in England, where he had a kind of vision in a rose garden. And then over the course of the next 5 years, he wrote three other long poems, and they were actually the last four poems that he wrote in his lifetime.
So over a six-year period he wrote these?
From 1936. The last two were published individually, I think, in 42 was the final one, and then they were published all together in 43. So he wrote them actually over the span of the Second World War. And when Kathy said that it's a great balm to be reading these words in difficult times, of course Eliot wrote them in England while London was being bombed, and there is a great sense of yearning and of solace in his quest for the greatest values of humanity in very dark, troubling times where we can't necessarily see the light.
And they're meditations, aren't they?
There are meditations in a way, but they are... My husband and I, a month ago, went to the three places in England that are named. We haven't been to the fourth place, which is at Cape Ann, where the Dry South Ages is set. And what you find when you go to the places is that these poems are remarkably concrete. And as they say, sometimes a cigar is just a cigar. And it grounds them in a way. So that they are both considering all the most complex abstractions that we consider, time and all, but they're grounded in a place. And it's...
sometimes we don't have to read too much into
it. No, sometimes the kingfisher is just a kingfisher. And the garden in Burnt Norton is exactly described. It's exactly what it looks like, exactly what it feels like to walk through it.
Maybe, Kathy, you could read us the opening of Burnt Norton, which is indeed a meditation on time and our perception of time.
Please.
Time present and time past are both perhaps present in time future and time future contained in time past. If all time is eternally present, all time is unredeemable. What might have been is an abstraction, remaining a perpetual possibility only in a world of speculation. What might have been and what has been points to one end, which is always present. Footfalls echo in the memory down the passage which we did not take, towards the door we never opened, into the rose garden.
Mm. Beautiful.
Really beautiful, isn't it? And I should also say that this is probably the first time, certainly the first time that we know of, that a woman has read these poems in public. They've been recorded. Isn't that astonishing? They've been recorded many times by great male actors, mainly British. May also be the first time that an American actor has read them. There's a very famous recording by T.S. Eliot himself. Jeremy Irons reads them often. Alec Guinness has read them. Ralph Fiennes has done a recording. But as far as we know, a woman's voice has never been heard reading these poems. And it's transformative to hear them, I think, in Kathleen Chalfont's remarkable voice.
The fact that you went to these places, is that out of curiosity, or is that to do, is that due diligence that I that you feel that you can't do justice to this unless you visit those places?
It's odd. It was, I now feel that I couldn't possibly have done justice to them without those visits. I went because Gideon said that he'd gone. He and Pam had gone, and I thought, oh, that would be nice. And it happened that I had a week, and my husband had a week, and we had two friends in England, both of whom are great lovers of Eliot. So we did, it's a circle around London. Not very far, it takes 2 days. It was wonderful, and now I can't imagine doing it without it.
It's a real pilgrimage, I have to say, and it's a great literary voyage that I think not many people take. And the first part is this garden in Gloucestershire, Burnt Norton, where Eliot had this. He broke into the garden with his girlfriend. It wasn't occupied at the time, and he had a kind of transcendent experience by a drained pool. And then the second one, East Coker, is a village in Somerset, and it's actually the village where Eliot's ancestors came from before they moved to the States. Eliot goes back and visits the ghosts of his ancestors, and actually Eliot and his wife, his second wife, are buried in the village church at East Coker. And so if one goes to that village now, you can visit Eliot's grave.
And one of the lines in the poem is, "In my end is my beginning, and in my beginning is my end."
And in and in East Coker, Eliot actually imagines, and again, this is another dance, great dance moment in the poems. Eliot imagines seeing the ghosts of his ancestors dancing in the open fields outside East Coker. And I wonder, Kathy, whether you might read this, because this is, it's one of the great, great set pieces of the poem where we encounter these ancient spirits dancing.
In my beginning is my end. Now the light falls across the open field, leaving the deep lane shuttered with branches, dark in the afternoon, where you lean against a bank while a van passes, and the deep lane insists on the direction into the village in the electric heat, hypnotized. In a warm haze, the sultry light is absorbed, not refracted by gray stone. The dahlias sleep in the empty silence, wait for the early owl. In that open field, if you do not come too close, if you do not come too close, on a summer midnight you can hear the music of the weak pipe and the little drum and see them dancing around the bonfire, the association of man and woman in dancing, signifying matrimony, a dignified and commodious sacrament. Two and two, necessary conjunction, holding each other by the hand or the arm, which betokeneth concord. Round and round the fire, leaping through the flames, or joined in circles, rustically solemn or in rustic laughter, lifting heavy feet in clumsy shoes, earth feet, loam feet, lifted in country mirth, mirth of those long since under earth, nourishing the corn, keeping time, keeping the rhythm in their dancing as in their living in the living seasons, the time of the seasons and the constellations, the time of milking and the time of harvest, the time of coupling of man and woman and that of beasts, feet rising and falling, eating and drinking, dung and death.
That's beautiful.
And then in the third part, Eliot revisits his childhood, his own childhood home. He grew up, of course, in St. Louis, but his family summered in Gloucester, Massachusetts. And in fact, Pam and I had the great privilege of spending a night in Eliot's childhood summer home in Gloucester, which is now owned by the T.S. Eliot estate. And then we took a fishing boat out to the Dry Salvages, this group of rocks, which is a couple of miles off the coast of Rockport that Eliot also writes about. And each of the poems is in a way about time, about different experiences of human time.
And it is so that the poem that the Dry Salvages talks both about the river in St. Louis.
The Mississippi.
And then moves to the sea. So right. That it's both his American life.
And then in the final poem, Little Gidding, which he wrote during the Blitz, during the German airstrikes that destroyed a large part of London, he finds a kind of consolation in spirituality. And this is the poem, I think, which is now, for me, the most moving, where Eliot pulls the lens back and says, even when mankind is really suffering, if we really think about the great arc of humanity, we can see that there is light and there is hope and there is beauty. And when we started this project 3 years ago, the presidential election had not happened, Brexit had not happened. We thought that we were creating a dance tribute to these poems. And it's been remarkable to see how Eliot's text and Pam's work as a choreographer has absorbed the world. Not to say that this is a dark event. Actually, I think the opposite. I think in dark times, we turn to great literature and art to point to another way of being and another way of thinking. And that's exactly what Eliot is encouraging us to do in these extraordinary poems.
Do you have an example of the poem?
Yes, this is this is going to be the T-shirt.
Literally.
Just the first part. This is the other thing is that throughout the poems, there are quotations. There are lots of Dante, lots of Milton, St. John of the Cross.
The Bhagavad Gita.
The Bhagavad Gita. And this is Julian of Norwich.
Who was a Julian of Norwich was a mystic, a medieval British mystic, and one of the great voices, one of the great feminine voices of the mystical tradition.
Sin is behovely, but all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well. If I think again of this place, and of people not wholly commendable, of no immediate kin or kindness, but some of peculiar genius, all touched by a common genius, united in the strife which divided them. If I think of a king at nightfall, of three men and more on the scaffold, and a few who died forgotten in other places, here and abroad, and of one who died blind and quiet, why should we celebrate these dead men more than the dying? It is not to ring the bell backwards, nor is it an incantation to summon the specter of a rose. We cannot revive old factions. We cannot restore old policies or follow an antique drum. These men and those who opposed them and those whom they opposed accept the constitution of silence and are folded in a single party. Whatever we inherit from the fortunate, we have taken from the defeated what they have to leave us, a symbol perfected in death, and all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well, by the purification of the motive in the ground of our beseeching.
Oh my God. Wow. All right, that's a good T-shirt, but it's a better poem. I just love the book that you're holding. That has some age on it. That's great.
Yeah, this is the edition of four quartets that I bought 25 years ago when I was an undergraduate. When
and
I read the poem for the first time.
Before that, it had been owned by a man named Fred Davis.
This is a hardback. This is a beautiful old green Faber hardback. And T.S. Eliot, of course, was the publisher of Faber. His day job was as a publisher of poems. And Kathy and I have both had the privilege of visiting T.S. Eliot's flat in Kensington in London, where he lived with his wife and where he died. And in that flat is a substantial part of his library as a publisher, including a copy of Ulysses that James Joyce gave him. So there are many layers to this project.
I don't mean to be unkind, but it seems to me just to be a shame that many people just know him from singing Cats.
Though we must say this
yes.
about Cats.
Yes.
Cats makes all the rest of it possible.
That's correct. That's
because
true.
Cats pays for it.
That's correct.
It's extraordinary.
That's correct.
I hope so. You were just reading that, and it was so affecting and so beautiful, and you have a tear coming down your.
I do every time.
I mean every time. I mean.
Well, yep. It's...
Wow.
Yeah,
well,
yeah.
The first time I saw you on stage was in Wit.
Mm.
I've never cried so much in a theater in my life. That has to have taken a toll.
Well, that was an extraordinary experience because it was one of those things... You see, for the character, the play ended in triumph.
Right.
And so had the play ended in the Code Blue section,
right,
it would have been awful and probably unbearable.
A woman with cancer,
but
isn't...
because she transcended somehow, I ended every evening in triumph, and that was a great thing. It was a great privilege to do that.
And of course, also a play in which the center of the play is great poetry,
right?
Because she's a John Donne. She's a
scholar.
And yes. She gets him wrong. And it's only through the doing of the living of her life that she understands.
I greatly enjoyed seeing Angels in America, but as I was sitting there, I was thinking, my God, I would have loved to have seen you in that.
Oh,
Kathy was in the first production.
The first production.
I was involved in it for 6 years, from 1988 until...
What a ride that must have been.
1984, yeah, it was quite something. And I have to say... My favorite character in all the world that I've ever played is Alexei Antediluvianovich Prilapsarianov, the world's oldest living Bolshevik. And theory, how are we to proceed without theory? A question which we well may ask.
The just when you, I can't get over what you just read, but I assume that everyone is sort of has that text. Everyone working on this. I mean, that's the guide, right? That's
the text is the guide.
That's the map
the
to
text,
everything.
The text is the guide, and it's shaped every decision that we've taken artistically has come from the text, and it's been a beautiful journey for Pam Tanowitz, the choreographer, to work out how to use the music of Eliot's language as an inspiration for. Choreography, and it's a long and serious piece. It's about an hour and 10 minutes long, and it is shot through by the beauty of these words, and four dazzlingly beautiful sets by Bryce and Kaya's music, which shimmers. It's for strings and electronics, and it features a harp very prominently, and the evening begins with Kathy's voice only. For the first 8 minutes, dance a solo dance to the opening of Burnt Norton that Kathy read, and then a harp shimmers into the picture, and then the work becomes musically more complex. And I don't want to give the ending away, but it's very special.
Well, we are out of time, but I can't thank you both enough for sharing this with audiences, but also sharing with us this morning. It's a great pleasure and a thrill to have you.
Well, it's
here.
Such a pleasure to be here, and
thank you so much.
We would love people to see it. It runs for three performances at the Fisher Center at Bard, July 6th through the 8th. Details are at fishercenter.bard.edu, and the production is then next year. Going to travel nationally and internationally, and I can't give you details yet, but for listeners who are not in the Hudson Valley, we hope that this remarkable project has a long life.
My thanks to you both. Be well.
Thank you.
Thank you.